I'm Nancy Cordes, in for Major Garrett. Welcome to The Takeout. Well, it is day five of deliberations in the Lindsey Clancy trial, and we seem to be moving closer to a mistrial. For the second day in a row, the jury reported that they are unable to reach a unanimous verdict. Clancy sat emotionless today as the judge ordered the jury to return to their discussions. He issued them what's termed the dynamite charge, strongly encouraging them to come to a consensus. Clancy, a former nurse, has admitted to killing her three young children, Cora, 5, Dawson, age 3, and 8-month-old Callan, back in January of 2023. What's in question is whether she can be held criminally responsible. The jury, made up of 9 women and 3 men, is showing no signs of a decision after more than 24 hours of cumulative deliberations. We're going to start off with CBS News correspondent Chanel Call, who joins us from her position outside the courthouse. Chanel, good to see you. A lot of action today. How close are we realistically getting to a mistrial here?
Hey, Nancy, good to see you, too. We're essentially one step away from a possible mistrial. What we heard happen in open court today was Judge Sullivan reading that dynamite charge out loud. I think we can play part of it for you, and then I'll tell you more about it after.
You have been selected in the same manner and from the same source from which any future jury would be. There is no reason to suppose that the case will ever be submitted to 12 persons more intelligent, more impartial, or more competent to decide it, or that more or clear evidence will be produced.
So, Nancy, this is sort of customary in Massachusetts law. It is a second time that a jury comes back and says we cannot reach a unanimous decision here. That's when that dynamite charge would be read aloud. Basically, what it is a final and formal instruction to the jury to please try again. You might have noted there in that piece of video that we showed you, Kevin Reddington, Lindsey Clancy's defense attorney's face and his emotion during that moment. As soon as the judge read the words future jury, Kevin Reddington looked pretty stressed. I mean, he was seen sort of rubbing his face, putting his hand over his mouth. He looked, in my opinion, tense. Lindsey Clancy was also there. And I'll note, Nancy, that this is somebody who, for the majority of testimony, during almost 21 days of testimony, she didn't spend a lot of time looking at the jurors. Today, while that dynamite charge was being read aloud, she was looking squarely at them.
That's interesting. This wasn't the only tense moment in the courtroom today, Chanel. The judge also questioned the jurors after a woman was arrested outside of the court. What happened there?
Yeah, a bit of an unusual start to our morning. Usually, Nancy, what we see is all 12 jurors enter the courtroom together at the same time. Today was a bit different. Judge Sullivan asked them to enter the courtroom one by one. He asked them 2 questions, which we couldn't hear, but they had to answer those 2 questions, each one by one, under oath. Once that happened and all 12 jurors enter the courtroom, he again talked to them about the fact that he needs them to come into this situation every day with a clear mind, with an open mind, and that if they had any concerns, he wants them to come forward. That did not happen today as a result of what happened yesterday, but he did want to make that distinction as soon as court resumed this morning. As for what happened yesterday, this was a bit of a chaotic situation. Massachusetts State Police say that they apprehended somebody who was on the backside of this court. So behind me here, Nancy, basically it's like media, members of the public would enter. If you're a juror, you would enter through a private entrance in the back of court. That's where this woman allegedly was. And police say that she was filming the jurors leaving court yesterday at about 3:40 p.m. on her phone. After she left, she was actually inside for her arraignment hearing. When she left, there was a swarm of media around her asking her a bunch of questions, as you would obviously imagine we would do. And she had said to us that she actually wasn't here to see the jurors. She said, "I didn't film the jurors. I was here to see Lindsey Clancy."
Wow. So much pressure on these jurors, even without situations like that. Chanel Call, thank you so much. CBS News legal contributor and federal criminal defense attorney Caroline Polisi joins me now for analysis. So, Caroline, is it safe to say at this point that the judge is getting close to declaring a mistrial here?
Oh, I'd say it's very safe. We are getting to the end of the road here. That dynamite charge, as Chanel alluded to, in the federal system, we call it an Allen charge, but all jurisdictions have them. Basically, it's a last resort, last-ditch effort to tell the jurors, please try your hardest to come to a verdict. The law favors coming to a verdict. There is no better jury out there in the pool and sea of citizenry out there than you are. You have all the facts. Please try to take a fresh look at the case. But at a certain point, that would dip over into coercion. So when they come back this next time, if they come back saying it's a deadlock, most likely the judge will declare a mistrial, which is an extremely frustrating outcome for really all parties involved.
How often after this discharge, this dynamite charge is made, do you see that a jury has a breakthrough?
Yeah, so the statistics are a little hazy and they vary by jurisdiction, but really it is between 40 and 60%. So it does, you know, produce a result some of the time. You know, the question is whether or not these jurors have the ability and the capacity to change their decisions. You know, part of the instruction is also not to give up your own conviction. So if you feel very strongly on one side or the other, I mean, there may just be a scenario where no juror is ever going to sort of change sides.
Okay, so let's say the judge does declare a mistrial. What happens then? How soon does it happen?
Yeah, so Lindsay Clancy is currently in pretrial confinement. She's being held at Tewksbury State Hospital. It's a mental health facility. She would stay there. She remains under indictment. It's up to the prosecutors to decide whether or not they want to move forward with prosecuting this case again. In my opinion, it feels like this district attorney will likely move forward with another prosecution if there is a mistrial. They seem like they want to find accountability for these murders. They charged the top charge, first-degree murder. In this instance, they were not open to plea negotiations, and I think they'll come out strong after if there is a mistrial. No timetable, really, but I would think they would want to at least alert the public and or, you know, Lindsay and her team about where they're seeing this going.
Who benefits, if anyone, if there is a mistrial declared?
So typically a retrial favors the prosecution because they get to refine their case. They get to see, you know, the pitfalls where maybe things didn't work out in their case. And I think that really especially applies here because the prosecution's case this time around was not very coherent. They made a lot of mistakes. It didn't necessarily add up from opening to closings. And I would think in a second trial, they would like to sort of fix that. And instead of trying to demean her mental health issues, be more sympathetic to those while also, of course, hammering home the law, meaning that their belief that she did have the capacity to conform her conduct to the law, regardless of what mental health struggles she was having at the time.
We don't have a lot of time, but can you just talk about how much pressure is on these jurors, given the national scrutiny of this case, and how might be affecting their deliberations?
We really hope it's not, because that would be an improper influence on the jurors. But it's very hard to imagine in this day and age that those jurors have not seen any media coverage about this. You can't really turn around and not see any of it. But they have been given that instruction every morning and every night not to talk to anybody about this case, not to consume social media about this case, not to watch television about this case. So if they're doing their duty, they are to make this decision based only on the facts as they viewed them inside that courtroom and nothing else.
Fascinating take. Caroline Polisi, legal contributor, thank you so much. Turning now to the Middle East, where the president today downplayed the importance of a peace deal while calling on Iranian citizens to take over their government. Meantime, Iranian officials are claiming a wedding party was hit by a U.S. strike and that more than 50 people were either killed or wounded. Central Command says they are looking into the reports, saying, quote, the U.S. military never targets civilians. CBS News senior White House correspondent Weijia Jiang joins us now from the North Lawn. Weijia, good to see you. So the Iranians fired on three separate U.S. allies overnight. What can you tell us about those attacks? And what is the White House saying about what comes next?
Nancy, you're right. They launched a mixture of ballistic missiles and drone strikes at Jordan, at Kuwait and Bahrain, and at a U.S. airbase in Iraq. This is precisely why, you remember earlier this summer, allies urged the president to try to reach a ceasefire, and one that held for just over a month until this recent round of strikes restarted, because Iran, even though obviously their capability has been deteriorated, still has, you know, the options to fire off exactly what you're seeing on your screen here. But the president responded today, calling those attacks a, quote, little love tap, and pointing out the strikes that the U.S. launched were much more powerful. He said that we destroyed a rocket that was aimed at putting new mines in the Strait of Hormuz, that CENTCOM was able to destroy communication systems and radar detectors. And also, Nancy, we should point out that before Iran even launched these strikes overnight, the president did warn that if they were to retaliate, there would be a much bigger price to pay. So we'll see if the U.S. responds again, but that is what the president promised even before they happened.
Weijia, the president has been pushing for a nuclear deal for months, which is why it was surprising to see him say yesterday, I'm not trying to force Iran to the bargaining table. Can you break down what he was saying there? Is this a new message?
It is new because for so long he has been talking about finding a solution. In fact, they changed their strategy from putting military pressure on Iran to economic warfare, which we saw last week. And of course, now there are both paths that are happening. But the bottom line is the president has always said he does want to make a deal with Iran, even though he has also indicated that they are not trustworthy brokers. And that's because at the end of the day, he wants this war to end. Because obviously it continues to have an impact here at home. He wants to be able to say he brokered a historic deal with Iran to end its nuclear ambitions. And so perhaps it is another strategy. We have seen the president carefully choose his words and apply pressure in other ways to bring not just Iran, but many adversaries back to the negotiating table.
Yeah, lots of economic pressure as well. Weijia Jiang, thank you so much. Let's bring in CBS News national security contributor Sam Vinograd. Sam, good to see you. So the president warned Iran against retaliating, and then they did just that overnight. They fired on Jordan, they fired on the UAE, and they fired on Kuwait. What does that tell you about where this conflict stands right now?
Well, certainly every day we're here calling the balls and strikes in each inning of this war that continues to drag on. And every day we realize that Iran retains the capability to asymmetrically attack the United States and its assets throughout the region. And that's probably going to continue, Nancy. That doesn't mean Iran's going to win the war. It means that Iran continues to retain the ability to inflict pain on the United States. So if we zoom out from that, what we know is that despite spending probably close to $40 billion, the United States has not degraded the Iranian regime's ability to hit back at us and is unlikely to do so at any point. So the question for the president, for the Secretary of Defense and others is, how long are we willing to take this versus acknowledging that our strategic goals in this war may not be attainable, which have shifted, as you just articulated with Weijia, from regime change to decimating the nuclear program to degrading Iran's support for proxies and more.
The Treasury Secretary says that the plan is to just tighten the screws economically on Iran until it breaks, and that that's what's going to push them to the bargaining table. But what do we know about Iran's willingness to withstand economic pain in the past?
Well, if we look at just military pain, and then I'll come to your very important economic question. You know, the Iranians fought the Iraqis for 8 years and lost hundreds of thousands of people. The Iranian economy has been under significant pressure for decades. Certainly maximum economic pressure, and I was in the administration at this time, did bring the Iranians to the negotiating table back for the first Iran deal. There was one difference there, which was that multilateral pressure on the Iranians was much greater than it was today. Russia and China were voting along with us at the UN, and there were other geopolitical dynamics in play. So the notion that we can tighten the screws on Iran economically quickly is just not going to happen. This is a longer-term game. It is an important game that the Secretary of the Treasury is playing, but this is not a light switch that you flip on or off, and that ultimately leads the Iranians to come begging for a deal.
Can I ask you about that Iranian claim about the wedding being struck by U.S. forces? What do we know about that situation?
We don't know a whole lot. We know that Iranian state media and others are claiming that the U.S. hit civilians. We know that the U.S. military is saying that they're looking into it. And we just don't have the facts yet, Nancy. I will say that there has been concern that the individuals responsible for mitigating civilian harm when it comes to U.S. military operations, that office has lost resources. So I don't want to jump to conclusions. The incident should be investigated. And we know the Iranians have a long history of lying about U.S. behavior, but there's a lot of questions out there.
Sam Vinograd, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Still to come on The Takeout, Democratic nominee for Texas Governor Gina Hinojosa. She's going to discuss the state of her campaign against Governor Greg Abbott. Also, New York Democratic Congressman Tom Suozzi is here. His argument as to why his party should reject the DSA. Plus, new lawsuits claim OpenAI put its public image ahead of safety in connection with a mass shooting at a school in Canada. We'll have the details of the accusations when we come back. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. Here's a look at what else we're watching this evening. After 9 months at sea, the USS Abraham Lincoln has docked in Thailand. Accusations have been made about poor living conditions on the aircraft carrier for the 5,000 service members aboard. Officials say this visit is for rest and recovery before the Lincoln returns to its base in San Diego. But even once it's there, officials say some activities and areas are off limits, including a prominent beach known for its nightlife. Tiger Woods was in court today where he pleaded no contest to reckless driving in his Florida DUI case. The golfer was in a rollover crash back in March where deputies said at the scene that he seemed impaired. Woods refused a urine test and told officers he had taken prescription medication. His license is being suspended for 5 years and he's being fined $1,000. This is his second DUI offense. The alleged head of a drug ring operating out of Penn State University was granted bail today. The 24-year-old Agostino Abatiello was ordered to have no contact with any witnesses. He is accused of trafficking cocaine out of two Penn State fraternities from 2023 to 2024. Five other defendants in the case also appeared in court today. As progressive and moderate Democrats debate the party's path forward, Congressman Tom Suozzi is calling on fellow Democrats to reject the DSA. He made his arguments in the Free Press and wrote, quote, "If Democrats fail to speak out against the DSA and its platform, the voters we need to win in 2026 may well conclude that our party is too radical to be trusted. Democrats must offer something better than the false choice between a broken status quo and ideological extremism." Congressman Suozzi is here with me and joins me now. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us in the middle of a very busy campaign season.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this was a fascinating piece. I found it really interesting. This is kind of the age-old argument. And I'm wondering how you recommend that the party make this case against Democratic Socialist candidates without turning off voters who see themselves as Democratic Socialist voters.
Well, I don't think that there are many voters that see themselves as Democratic Socialist voters. I think that what's happening right now is people are unhappy. The status quo is not working for people. And there is a concentration of wealth, and there is a problem with climate change and with immigrant injustice, and there's a lot of problems in our society right now. And people are unhappy. And I think that the mayor of New York City, Zohran Mamdani, and Donald Trump, both in their campaigns, recognized people's unhappiness and said, you know what, everything's broken, let's blow the whole thing up and start over. That's not the answer. America's always had problems. We've always faced problems throughout our history, but we work together to try and figure out how to fix the problems. The answer is not to reject the two principles on which this country is founded, which is capitalism and democracy. So the far left wants to get rid of capitalism, and Donald Trump and some of his followers want to get rid of democracy by having a strong chief executive and forget about the Congress and the Supreme Court and everybody else. Those are not the answers. The answers are to work together to fix the very real problems we face in our society today, the same as we have throughout our history.
Which specific DSA policies do you think the party needs to reject most strenuously?
Well, they want government to control major corporations in the country related to everything from food and medicine to utilities to so many other different things. They want to get rid of the Senate, the United States Senate, and they want to have only one house, the House of Representatives, and they want the House to appoint the Supreme Court and to pick the president the way they do for a prime minister in other countries. They don't want to have the checks and balances system that we currently have. They want to defund the police. They want to defund the Department of Defense. They want to get rid of prisons. They want to have open borders. This is their July 14th platform. This is not some, you know, I'm not making this up. This is what's written in their platform. And so these are bad ideas. And we have to recognize that, you know, some DSA candidates may not be mentioning these specific policies, but this is their platform. I've been in politics for a long time, and I've always got to defend the Democratic platform. And they've got to defend the DSA platform, and it's in a horrible platform.
At the same time, so much of the turnout in even general elections often has to do with how fired up the base is, how fired up the right and left wings are. I mean, I'm thinking President Trump would not have been elected if he didn't have so much MAGA support. If you think back to 2010, you know, would we have seen a swing in the House of, what was it, 63 Republican members if you didn't have the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party pushing that?
Well, I don't think that that's the case, really. I think that what in primaries, you have this very fired up base of people that really matter. And that's one of the big problems in our country right now. Of the 435 seats in Congress, 400 seats are safe seats. You can't lose. 200 Republicans are going to win the Republican seat. 200 Democrats are going to win the Democratic seat. So when you're in the safe seat, you don't have to listen to the people. You only worry about the people who vote in your primary. And the primary is a very small subset of the general public. It's like less than 18% of the public vote in primaries on average. So the Republicans pander to their extreme base. The Democrats pander to their extreme base. And that's one of the things dividing our country. If you look at presidential contests in that history, in modern history, the candidate that did probably the worst for the Republicans was Barry Goldwater, where he got 40% of the vote. One of the candidates that did the worst for the Democrats was George McGovern. He got about 40% of the vote. So you're always going to get 40% for the Democrats and 40% for the Republicans. It's that 20% in the middle where the fight is over. And that's not the people that you're talking about, those extreme votes. That's more the moderate votes that right now are saying, you know what, the whole system stinks.
So if there's a House race where you've got a DSA candidate pitted against a Republican candidate, are you recommending that voters go with the Republican?
No, I would never recommend that people vote for the Republican. But you have to recognize that a DSA candidate's not going to win in a moderate seat. When you see DSA candidates winning, they're winning in deep, deep blue seats. Mm-hmm. When you see Republicans win, they're winning, Freedom Caucus people, they're winning in deep, deep red seats. In swing seats that could go either way, you got to listen to all the people. You can't just listen to your base. You have to listen to, like in my seat, I have a seat that Donald Trump won by 19,000 votes. I can't just listen to the Democrats. I got to get the large majority of the Democrats. I have to get the majority of the independents. And I even need a few Republicans to vote for me. So I have to listen to all the people. That's what's good about competitive seats. That's why gerrymandering is so bad. That's why we have so many safe seats. It's bad for America because the Republicans are just listening to their base. The Democrats are just listening to their base and nobody's solving any problems.
Should you listen to the DSA? Is there anything that they are saying that you think the Democratic Party should absorb?
There's a role for extreme people in our society, whether it's the far right or the far left, to push the window as far as ideas you should be considering. But I don't, doesn't mean I adopt their principles.
Right.
When they're out there enraged about the concentration of wealth in America, they're probably right. There is too much concentration of wealth in America. We need to fix it. The answer is not to get rid of capitalism. The answer is to try and do what Theodore Roosevelt did in the 1900s or FDR did in the 1920s or Johnson and Clinton, Kennedy did in the 1960s. Those were all fixes to the capitalist system. They weren't throwing out capitalism. They were fixing it by doing the New Deal and doing Social Security and doing Medicaid and doing Medicare. You can fix things without throwing out the whole system.
Congressman Tom Suozzi of New York, thank you so much. We appreciate you stopping in to talk about a really fascinating piece.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the new lawsuits that accuse OpenAI of aiding and abetting a mass shooter. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Democrats are still weighing whether they are going to punish the two lawmakers who helped advance the Republicans' agenda, which includes a resolution that condemns socialism. Yesterday, Congressman Jared Golden of Maine and Congresswoman Marie Glusenkamp-Perez voted to advance the bill without notifying House leadership. Oops. The resolution also contains language praising President Trump's Save America Act, which Democrats definitely do not support. Eight Democrats ended up voting for the legislation. Let's bring in our political panel, Republican strategist and former senior advisor to Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, Kevin Sheridan, and Democratic strategist and former director of DNC chair Jamie Harrison's office, Haima Moore. Good to see both of you. Haima, is this on Hakeem Jeffries for not taking the role and figuring out how his members were going to vote?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot going on right now. And I think what I'm hearing from Democrats who are not here in D.C., is they don't want this infighting to keep going. They want Hakeem Jeffries to stay focused on getting Democrats elected in the fall and taking back Congress. But look, eight members voted for this resolution in the past. And when you think about this, it's not just about the gamesmanship that the Republican Party is starting to put into play, which I thought was really well done. You have eight Democrats who are going to go back to their districts, run for reelection, and they can't explain not voting for condemning socialism right now. And so it was smart on their part, but I do think Democrats want Hakeem Jeffries is to keep his caucus focused on winning in November and keep the infighting down a little bit.
Kevin, how much does this even matter? I mean, at the end day, this is a messaging measure, but it does.
It's a messaging bill. 192 Democrats did vote against it. So that's obviously those aren't the you know, those are the safer seats, obviously. So, yeah, look, this is important to get them on the record. They're you know, condoning socialism, but honestly, it's the, you know, whether there's moderates in the Democratic caucus anymore or just people that talk moderately, I think is a big difference, because when these guys get in power, they do the same thing. But Joe Biden ran as a moderate. He opened the borders. He spent trillions of dollars on green new energy deals. And, you know, he did many of the things that DSA is calling for. They just want it 10 times more. So it's not like the party, all the energy in the party is on the DSA side, I would say.
It does show that the party is grappling with how exactly to position and handle the DSA, right?
I mean, look, I think this is a healthy fight right now. I think Democrats have not had the opportunity over the last 5 years to have this conversation. I think what happened in 2024 is we were sort of forced in a process that did not allow for this to happen. We've elected across the board the spectrum of Democrats over the last cycle, from Abigail Spanberger in Virginia all the way to Mamdani in New York.
Case in point,
and
so, she ran as moderate. I mean, She's not moderate.
And I think Democrats are showing that the tent is big. And I think the prevailing thought right now is, can Democrats have a vision beyond Donald Trump, a vision beyond just being fighters, a vision beyond just socialism? And that's the question that I think voters want to ask and want to have answered right now.
I want to ask you about something that Susan Collins said to Politico in their On the Road podcast. She outlined what she would tell President Trump about his trade war with Canada. Let's take a quick listen.
I would remind him that Canada is our friend, our closest ally, and our biggest trading partner. This is not China that we're talking about. This is not an adversarial country. Right. And that our economies are so linked that if you try to hurt one, you end up hurting Maine and other border states.
So, Kevin, for a border state candidate like Susan Collins, does this trade war hurt her because it ties her to a very unpopular policy that President Trump is pushing, or does it give her an opportunity to separate herself from President Trump?
She's
and make
always
that
been
case?
Triangulating against Trump since he's come on the scene. Obviously, that plays well for her. Maine is obviously right next to Canada, but Canada bears a lot of the responsibility for this, and I think she can message that as well. Because although they are our friend, Carney is not acting like a friend. They blew up that deal to hurt the Republican Party in the midterms. And now they're going to go right back to the negotiation table. As soon as, if Republicans lose, they're just going to go back. This was a political move by Carney.
How does the Democratic Senate candidate in Maine, Troy Jackson, take advantage of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have to say one thing. So this has been one of Susan Collins' best interviews this cycle, and she's proving that she's trying to lay foundation for fighting back in this cycle. And she is trying to define Troy Jackson. She's trying to define who she is. And she is trying to make sure people know.
Too.
No, right. But I think what Troy Jackson's got to do is he's got to make sure that he's one defining himself. She had some really good questions. If you listen to the interview, she has some really good questions about where he stands on affordability, ideology, and things like that. So he's got to make sure that he knows where he stands on those things. Mm-hmm. And then to Kevin's point, I think he's got to make sure that he is being America first in a way that presents Maine as the winner of this, not as the question mark.
Really quick, because we got to go. Yeah. I want to ask you about Senator Ed Markey winning his primary in Massachusetts. I thought that Democrats were punishing all the older candidates this cycle. Does that turn out not to be the case?
Well, Nancy, it's a little bit of both. I don't think that we're abandoning the generational fight. That's still happening in many districts around the country. But what we saw in Massachusetts is two things happened last night. You have a new person coming to take over said multi-seat, but you also saw Ed Markey coming back because Democrats there want they want to have experience.
Republicans have won statewide in Massachusetts before.
Yeah, they win at the governor's level, not at the congressional level for a very long time. But look, what Markey's opponent got in trouble with was saying he didn't want his daughters playing against boys in sports. Mm-hmm. And then he had to apologize for it for the rest of the campaign. Mm-hmm. And he looked like a phony in the end. So I think they just got, you know.
Gotta go. Thank you both so much, Kevin Sheridan, Time and More. Appreciate it. Happy Labor Day weekend. And happy Wednesday to you, everyone. This is The Takeout, the daily report. It's coming up next. Thanks for being with us.